Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Four Against the West, the true saga of a frontier family that reshaped the nation and created a legend, by Joe Pappalardo, narrated by Jim Siebert. Everything that you have told me I found to be true, and I am led to believe that, if there is such a noble and high virtue in the art of guessing, three other men like you cannot be found in the world. Emperor Bahramo, in the peregrination of the young sons of the King of Serendib. Cristoforo Armeno, relating a Persian folktale, 1557. The family weakens by the length we travel. 3 days. Jane's Addiction, 1990. Introduction. There's a simple formula for biographies that has existed since John Boswell finished The Life of Samuel Johnson in 1791. Pick an inspirational subject and spend hundreds of pages describing why that person's life was pivotal to history. It's a good formula, and this book ignores it entirely. Instead of an individual, this tome traces four lives in parallel. Those of the famous Judge Roy Bean and his brothers, James, Samuel, and Joshua. And instead of providing inspiration, each is, at some point during his saga, bound to rub folks the wrong way. They did so while alive. Why should listeners feel any differently? However, these questionable men are also fascinating. Each was immersed in the formative history of the U.S. Southwest, making appearances on the Santa Fe Trail, in the Mexican-American and Civil Wars, on the California coast during the Gold Rush, in Wild West Texas train construction camps, and prowling the deserts and mountains of pre-state New Mexico and Arizona. That's an alluring amount of epic American frontier history to cover with a single litter of brothers. The strange phenomenon of siblings is that their similarities make it easier to compare differences. The Bean brothers aspired for comparable things, but set about achieving them in very different ways. They crossed and shared paths, often dramatically, but each eventually carved his own way through the evolving American landscape. Each brother experienced the frantic spread of the United States during the era of manifest destiny. This remains a loaded term in the 21st century as much as when it was coined in the mid-1800s. It today generates a lot of emotion, anger, nostalgia, guilt, and regional pride. Those less steeped in the era may be surprised at how a disparate mix of greed, ambition, brute force, and civic responsibility, sometimes embodied in the same person, created the contemporary United States. The emergence of coast-to-coast America empowered a generation to believe they could influence the development of an entire continent, and they proved they could. They routinely did terrible and amazing things, to paraphrase W.E.B. Du Bois, that expanded the edge of their style of civilization. But who were the people who rode the wave of the manifest destiny? They weren't cardboard cutouts of heroes and villains, as easy as that would be to process. The truth is more nuanced, and therefore interesting. Seeing manifest destiny from the point of view of the humans swept up in it transforms the national experience into a story of personal choices, circumstances, and consequences. This is where profiling four brothers comes in handy. When one takes a fork in the road, historically, it opens up more than just a new setting. It represents a choice to join the army, to settle in Mexico, to run for office, to support the Confederacy, that another brother faced. Four Against the West tells the brothers' true stories, but doesn't dissect them in academic dissertations or with overt moralizing. We don't have to judge them by modern standards or explain away their behavior as being of their time. We can measure each brother against the other, just by following the adventurous narratives of their lives. They are mirrors to each other, even at a distance. And I think, from the beginning, you'll find that the brothers don't deserve an equal amount of deference. But don't feel obligated to like or dislike Roy, Sam, Josh, or James. You don't have to root for them to enjoy this book. But you do have to be willing to travel with these brothers over many long miles to understand them. Do that, and you'll witness four stunning examples of the raw human drive that ushered in the rise of modern America. Joe Papalardo, Texas, 2023. Part 1. Empire Plants Itself Upon the Trails. William Gilpin, Mission of the North American People, 1874. Roy, Louisville, Kentucky, March 1841. Fantley Roy Bean, Jr. eyes the flatboat with excitement and trepidation. This floating wooden shack, scarcely 50 feet long and made of scrap wood, will be the 16-year-old's home for the next 2 months. It has no keel. That had cost too much time and money, and therefore will depend on the crew, of which he's now one, to steer it with long poles. It's more than 800 miles from the banks of the Ohio River to the skiff's destination in New Orleans. That's a long way to be dodging sandbars, steamboats, and river pilots. But Roy, the name he now uses, is too eager to leave to feel many nerves. When he does, there's bourbon. These commercial boats require at least 4 crew and a pilot, who are contracted per trip. Roy's a strapping youth, good with horses and familiar with rifles from a lifetime of hunting. He can read and is learning to gamble. And coming from a family of southern landowners, he's comfortable manhandling slaves. That's an important quality given the cargo the flatboat is carrying. 12 people, destined for sale in the slave markets of New Orleans. It's been illegal to import slaves from outside the United States since 1808, but Congress's action did nothing to stem the internal market. The population of rural Kentucky is in steep decline, and as people leave, they sell their slaves. The prices in New Orleans, the premier market for the human trade, are much higher than in Kentucky. At $600 to $1,200 a person, even a handful of slaves will pay for the trip and cover the crew's pay. Thousands every year make the trip after being sold down the river, and the unsavory business leaves slave-driving bargemen eager to find crew. Even an untested teenager, if they show enough pluck. And Roy has pluck to spare. Running away from home is the best example of this. It's a bold move, but Roy sees it as an obvious one. There's little to keep him in Kentucky besides his family, and the Bean family is on a downward trajectory. In fact, the entire country seems to be faltering. When Roy was a child in Mason County, his family owned a sizable parcel of land and plenty of people to work on it. An 1820 census listed a homestead of 32 people. Only 6 of them were Bean family members: Father Flantley, Mother Anna, and their 4 children. James was the eldest, born in 1814. Joshua was next, born in 1818, followed the next year by Samuel. Keeping pace, Sarah provided some household gender balance in 1820. Their parents must have exhausted themselves, Roy figured, because he didn't arrive until 1825. The Bean children grew up in an entitled existence of household servants, field slaves, and obedient hired hands. There were 8 slaves in the family's holdings, 5 of whom were females under 24 years old. The homestead also had a workforce of 16 hired laborers, all living on site. Flantley Sr., who went by Francis, was a skilled surveyor who took work establishing new post roads and racetracks. He also diversified. For example, he and his brother Benjamin in 1818 jointly backed a man named William Conant from Maeslick in opening a tavern. It was the first saloon in which the Bean family is known to have been involved, but it was far from the last. Roy's father was a charismatic and energetic man, a larger-than-life figure to his sons. He was given to delivering speeches in his lingering Irish brogue. Flatley Sr. consistently demonstrated how a man sizes up opportunities and uses confidence to claim them. His boys each shared a belief that they were men of action, who deserved to capitalize on circumstances no matter where in the world they found them. Nature and other lesser men needed to yield before their ambitions. Even James, the eldest and most responsibly minded brother, inherited an aggressive pride. These traits were not unique to the Bean family. They were hallmarks of American culture, particularly in the South. These attitudes migrated with settlers going into the Western frontier and in time became the tenets of what's called manifest destiny. Kentucky dashed the proud aspirations of the Bean family. In March 1825, they sold a 54-acre tract of land to neighbor Thomas Wells and moved from Mason into a humbler homestead in Shelby County. The 1930 census showed a household of just 17 people, the family and 8 slaves. By then, the Beans were already in a financial retreat, and things were about to get much worse. In 1833, a cholera epidemic scythed through Kentucky, killing tens of thousands. The extended Bean family was swept into the carnage. A family slave named Harry Nichols offered a window on their suffering when he later recalled helping family members bury 3 of Old Man Bean's children, among many others. It's the first of several sporadic outbreaks, the disease sadistically taking long breaks between lethal waves. In October 1835, Fantley Bean Sr. was struck down by a runaway team of horses, which killed him instantly. Any hope to hold the family together in Shelby County fell to James at 21 years old and Joshua at 20. Sarah was 15, Sam 14, and Roy just 10. After their father's death, Kentucky's cholera-raged economy only grew worse. In 1837, the banks in the state all failed. It had something to do with the Bank of England overextending itself with loans, leading to a cut of all credit issuance to Americans, which halved the price of cotton that year. This, in turn, shuttered cotton companies and banks in New Orleans, and the infection reached New York, causing the Joseph's Banking Company to close and precipitating the Panic of 1837, which crashed the dollar and tanked the entire U.S. economy. There was blame to go around. The loose credit in England, Andrew Jackson dissolving the Bank of the United States, bad weather, and the Depression proved deep and lasting. Southern states suffered worse. The entire nation spoke of a malaise, but Kentuckians dubbed the era between 1834 and 1844 the crisis decade. Given the resurgent cholera and sputtering economy, this generation of Beans never had much of a chance in Kentucky. Roy has watched his community, state, and nation cracking apart. Who could blame him for cutting out? Hell, Uncle Ben didn't stick around to watch the world collapse around him any further. He left Kentucky in 1837. Leaving an imploded economy and family graves behind for the promise of a place called Missouri. Benjamin Bean, from all reports, has settled on his own land near a lake outside the town of Independence, when it was just an obscure fur trade village on the edge of the settled United States. Since then, the hamlet has become the premier jumping-off point for settlers, traders, and explorers heading to the foreign lands of New Mexico, Oregon, and California. Roy is natural at justifying actions he clearly wants to take for his own gratification, and he applies this skill to abandoning his family in Kentucky. With him gone, his brothers will have one less thing to worry about. Strapping horseman Joshua is ready to head off on his own, not to start a family per se, but to escape the laborious monotony of homesteading. Everyone knows that community-minded James will snare a wife as soon as he's able, but if Roy knows his brother at all, he expects him to go to Missouri. The eldest Bean tends to pander to and emulate his elders, and he'll float to his uncle in Missouri like a leaf pulled behind the wake of a barge. If Uncle Ben continues to find success out there, Roy bets James'll make the leap, whether he's married or not. If the family doesn't move west, Sam might just go renegade, like Roy is now doing. The pair are in many ways opposites, Sam with blonde hair, Roy with dark, Sam slow-spoken and Roy quick-tongued, Sam largely abstaining from drink, Roy happily indulging. But they share a streak of adventurism. The two indulge this trait as young squires roaming the hills and fields of Kentucky. Roy hopes his departure will ignite Sam's spirit of adventure, even if running off to New Orleans is too extreme an act. In any case, his brother is far too soft on slaves to consider working on a flatboat to New Orleans. Roy has grown wilder than his elder siblings, having lived without a father for more of his childhood than the others. He's clever and observant, but frustrated and rootless. And there's no reason to stay put. Not while there's a sprawling trade network running along the nation's great rivers. As soon as he's old enough to be hired, Roy heads to nearby Louisville to find a flatboat. From there, on a rudderless barge carrying forlorn slaves, he can take the Ohio River to where it meets the Mississippi and head straight south for New Orleans and whatever the future holds. Mississippi River, April 1841. Nights on the flatboat are both quiet and tense for the man on watch. Tonight it's Roy, who puffs on a cigar to stay alert. His ears strain for any noise in the darkness. Telltale splashes of incoming pirate boats, clicks of firearms being readied, the scrape of metal blades being pulled from scabbards. Among the din of frogs, birds, and other riverside animals, anyone could be mustering for an attack. But the rifles, knives, and pistols the crew carry are not just meant to repel river pirates. Roy considers their cargo, chained together under the glare of a lantern, as the real threat. He's not just a boat crewman, he's also a prison guard. Even by the standards of a Kentucky slave's miserable condition, being shipped to New Orleans is a nightmare of cruel uncertainty. Being separated from all friends and family and sent away for resale creates a dangerous desperation. Slave rebellions have occurred during trips down the river, with flatboat crews killed during the bids for freedom. Roy sees lights downstream, and they're getting larger. It must be a steamboat churning toward them. In daylight, he'd see the telltale smudge of stack smoke on the horizon. As the vessel gets closer, he can hear music on board and spies dark figures silhouetted in lamplit windows. To the steamboat's crew, Roy's slave skiff is a dot of light away from the river center. But to the teenager, the steamboat is a reminder of the wider community on the Ohio and Mississippi rivers. Both are plied by watercraft of all sizes and are serviced by a network of forts, trading stations, and taverns on the banks. These built-from-scratch outposts are hubs for news, political machinations, and commercial negotiations. In the world's empty places, a saloon can become a beacon of civilization. Each stop has been an education for Roy. Drinking, gambling, and fighting are a way of life for these rough, working rivermen, and the teenager proves to be a quick student. Best of all, he's not alone in the world while he's at a saloon. Or at least he's alone with everybody else. New Orleans, Louisiana, May 1841. Roy stands among the back of the crowd at the trader's yard. having shown up late to the auction's 10 a.m. start. Attending the slave auction is not part of his job as a flatboat crewman, which ended on arrival, but he's never seen one before, and it seems like he should watch the end of his first trip. New Orleans is slavery's unparalleled hub in the United States. Other cities confine their slave pens to one district, but this yard is just one of more than 50 sprinkled across New Orleans. Some are under rotunda domes, others like this one are conducted in open-air markets. Humans are bought and sold every Saturday and Sunday. Taking in the place's high brick walls and armed staff, Roy can see that the facility is an auction house only part of the time. It's really a full-time prison for slaves awaiting sale. The enslaved are assembled to one side. Roy scans the glum faces for those he shipped here, but it's not easy among the throngs. The men, women, and children on sale are of varying ages, each freshly washed, with hair combed and wearing clean clothes. They seem a far cry from the huddled, moaning cargo lying on the hard deck of the flatboat. When spectators would come in the yard, the slaves were ordered out to form a line, an escaped slave Henry Bibb will describe in his memoirs. They were made to stand up straight and look as sprightly as they could, and when they were asked a question, they had to answer it as promptly as they could and try to induce the spectators to buy them. If they failed to do this, they were severely paddled after the spectators were gone. And the object for flogging under such circumstances is to make the slaves anxious to be sold. When he and the flatboat crew dropped off their cargo at the yard, Roy was able to see the staff using their equipment to punish uncooperative slaves. Several had been pushed over, elbows touching knees, with a stick forced between the bends of their limbs. Hands tied and helpless, they endure beatings by the auctioneers who use wooden paddles, the flat sides pitted with auger holes that form deep blisters on the skin. Roy noticed that the blows only land where prospective buyers won't be able to see the damage. He spots a throng of slaves, their faces unemotional, dancing in a courtyard under the watchful eyes of the trade pen overseers. The idea, he's told, is to increase their health with some light exercise. To this end, the slaves are also scrutinized by doctors and given healthy portions of food. It's not humane, it's just good for sales. There are slaves exposed for bidding, i.e. displayed on the auction block, but most of the action happens on the sidelines, where savvy buyers can get a good look at the humans they're considering for purchase. Prospects are often taken into rooms and stripped, then examined for indications of disease or scars from neck chains or beatings, signs of unwanted defiance. Once in a while, a man or woman will act out, usually when a family is being split apart. There's begging and crying, but such outbursts are rare and quickly tamped with brute intimidation. "I would have cried if I dared to," writes Solomon Northrup, who that same year experiences an auction from the perspective of those being sold after seeing a mother and child forcibly separated in a trade yard. The final step is a trip to the notary tables. Under Louisiana law, all slaves must be recorded by notaries in the city, who deliver this bureaucracy from several desks on site. As the novelty wears off, Roy finds slave sales a morose and dull process. He quickly gets bored and leaves. On the street, it's impossible to forget that he's unemployed. Flatboats can't navigate upstream, so he knew it would be a one-way trip. He idly wonders if the skiff's owner got even a third of its $75 construction cost when he sold it. With his pay, he could take a steamboat north toward home. But with some money in pocket and New Orleans to explore, what's the rush? Roy turns his back on the slave market's tall brick wall and the miseries inside, strides down cobblestone streets toward the Garden District, and the city of New Orleans swallows him. James. Independence, Missouri, October 1844. The sound of rifle fire brings the town of Independence to attention. Dozens of dirty, weary men in a wagon train are heralding the end of their journey from Independence to Santa Fe and back again. Just as a seaside port town turns out when its residents hear the celebratory cannon fire of returning ships, many in Independence hear gunshots and reflexively go to the downtown square to watch caravans arrive. James Bean heads specifically to the Owens and All store on the square. This is not only a logical and popular place to gawk. The establishment has been the premier local outfitter of wagon trains for years, but while he's there, James can mix with the Santa Fe Trail merchants, learn their trade, and gather some market intelligence about the trip and the destination, and hopefully demonstrate his diligent interest to Samuel C. Owens, who not only owns the store, but funds startup traders with their first wagons for a cut of the profit. There's nothing quite like a Missouri freighter. A dozen are parked in the square, their white canvas covers still eye-catching despite the months of dust and grime smeared across their surfaces. They're each handcrafted Conestoga-style wagons, with telltale curved bodies and outward canted end gates. But they're larger than wagons used elsewhere. Engineers saved the Santa Fe trade by designing these heavier haulers after New Mexico Governor Manuel Armijo imposed a new customs duty of $500 per wagon in 1839. In 1844 alone, dozens of these super-size vehicles, bearing 5,000 pounds each and pulled by teams of oxen or mules, crossed the Great Plains each season heading for Mexico. An estimated 92 wagons traveled down the Santa Fe Trail that year. Most, but not all, were freighters. Independence has come a long way, and it's all because of migration and commerce. The village, the westernmost port on the Missouri River, was founded in 1827 as the jumping-off point for the western frontier fur trade. That geographic distinction means more now than ever, as throngs of pioneers stock their wagons with supplies here before heading out to Oregon or California. The fur business has all but given way to a thriving trade with the northern Mexico cities of El Paso del Norte and Chihuahua. During the winter months, Missouri traders purchase goods in the east and bring them to the trailheads in Independence. Departures begin in early May. Caravans expect to accomplish between 10 and 18 miles a day and can reach their destinations within a month and a half. The return trips start in September. The wagon train arriving today is the first of this season. James spots the stout frame and blonde hair of his younger brother Sam, who's milling around the storefront and chatting up the hired men. The returned traders are enjoying the attention of the throng of friends, family, and interested strangers. The traders seem to be oblivious to their stink. One of Independence's earliest residents, John McCoy, will later describe the strange ability of the men to ignore their own accumulated filth. A greasy, dirty set of men they were. Water surely was a rare commodity with them. They little cared for it, except to slake their thirst. The stories are already in the air. Comanches and Arapaho charging from hilltops. False ponds shimmering in the air to tempt thirsty travelers. Desert trails empty of everything but the ruins of failed wagons and animals. And buffalo herds that stretch to the horizon. The men will camp outside the small town, engaging in all-night revelries that attract Sam Bean and other eager local youths. The hardships of the voyage and what they had suffered they knew would not be so interesting to the boys, and that phase of the trip was purposely kept in the background, Sam would later realize. To cap the climax, they would wind up with a graphic description of the dark-eyed señoritas in the land of the Montezumas. That was a clincher. Nothing thrilled my nerves so much as the stories the Teamsters would tell us in Independence, where a large number were congregated.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?